Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. At sundown on Wednesday, November the 27th, when most Americans will be preparing for Thanksgiving, America's Jewish community will also be celebrating the first night of Hanukkah. The last time these two holidays converged was in 1888. And the next time will be in 79-8-11. So let's get this party started. We'll hear from New Orleans' preeminent 20th century kosher caterer, Catholic Creole Bertha Pichon. Then, NOLA Pie Guy Nate Winters here to share his Thanksgiving dessert secrets. We'll even meet Madeline Wright, the creator of Spinach Madeline. So happy Thanksgivica! It's time for Louisiana Eats. For over 40 years, if you were planning a catered affair for kosher guests in New Orleans, your caterer was most likely to be Bertha Pichon. Mrs. Pichon, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you. I'm honored.
And if you don't mind, I'm going to call you Bertha.
Not at all.
Now, how in the world did a Creole Catholic young woman make it into the kosher kitchen?
Well, because everybody was a caterer doing their own thing. So I'm saying to myself, if I have to work this hard, I'm going to become a kosher caterer. I just had to find out the restrictions because I knew they were strict.
So you started learning in people's homes.
I did. I worked in Orthodox Jewish homes to learn the fundamentals of kosher cooking.
Okay.
You know, because nobody could teach it unless you work in a Jewish home.
How did your interest in cooking begin in the first place?
Basically, how I learned to cook was from my mother. I am the oldest girl in the family, and I was like the second mother. My mother had 15 children. I had to be like on her apron string. She needed me. I had three brothers older than I am.
And they were hungry, I'm sure.
Oh, love to eat. But anyhow, she would say, Bertha Ann, come help me. Will you get the garlics? She was a real Creole cook.
Uh-huh.
Creole cooks cook with a lot of seasoning, but they love bell pepper. And yeah, that makes the difference in a Creole cooking, the bell pepper, and a Cajun cooking.
What neighborhood in New Orleans did you grow up in?
We always lived in a Tremé, as I remember. But I think when my mother and them were young, they lived in the 7th Ward because my grandfather built the first Corpus Christi church.
So I guess growing up tied to your mother's apron strings, I guess it was a natural jump then into a professional life in cooking. How did that begin?
I wanted to be a dietitian, but they couldn't afford to send me to school. Then I went and learned to serve parties with Lucy Ada.
And who was that?
Lucy Ada was a wonderful person. She worked and served for the Jews, but she didn't do kosher work. They had a Jewish woman, Miss Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
She was making the kosher food, but she was older then. So she asked me, Miss Pichon, would you like to come do kosher foods? And she didn't have to teach me to cook. She just had to teach me the fundamentals and the restrictions. And she's the one who really taught me how to make knishes. Knishes is a little pie. I knew about the gefilte fish. I really learned a lot from her.
And was she the person who first brought you into the synagogues?
No. Miss Pennant, Molly Pennant, brought me into the first affair in the synagogue. They had a conservative synagogue on Napoleon and Magazine.
Okay.
Tikvah Shalom.
Uh-huh.
And that's when I was accepted by Rabbi Hoffman. One time, that was a bad word, kosher. Really?
For years, nobody knew I was a kosher caterer, because you'd say, I'm a kosher caterer. Say, what that mean? You know, and I didn't want to explain all that. I didn't want to tell them it took 7 years for me to be accepted through an Orthodox rabbi. And I was young, believe me.
How old were you when you started working?
That's a bad question. I've been working since I'm about 10 or 11. But in the food business, I was about 24. For me to be a kosher caterer, I had to make things from scratch. They didn't have all this food they have today for kosher products.
And I bet also that even the flavors to a Catholic Creole woman, the flavors must have been startling.
Well, I think that's what made me successful in a kosher caterer. I always put a little Creole touch in it. But, you know, you couldn't prepare nothing until a rabbi inspect every product for me. I worked in Beth Israel Synagogue.
So that is, was that your first job on your own in kosher catering when you went to work for Beth Israel?
Yes. And I wanted to work there.
That was the old original one on Carondelet Street.
Exactly.
And I believe at that time that was one of the very largest Orthodox congregations in New Orleans. So you were cooking for the Orthodox Jews.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, what did that entail?
That entailed that I couldn't bring one package in there open.
Okay.
Everything I bought, I had to bring it sealed. In the beginning, I bought a lot of kosher meat from Mr. Ralph Rosenblatt.
Where was his butcher shop?
On Ferret.
Ah.
The only kosher butcher that I knew of in New Orleans. And then we had Long's Bakery on Ferret and Jenna.
And he was a kosher baker.
He was a kosher baker. So then after the rabbi recommended me to do this ufruf.
What is that?
Ufruf is a breakfast or luncheon. Something like a bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah. But it's for the groom. It's before he get married. So that was my very big first experience. And I went to Mr. Ralph, and I said, Mr. Ralph, I have to have such and such a thing. Okay, Miss Pichon, we got everything. And they wanted me to be successful. I had a lot of nice Jewish people that wanted me to be successful. But, of course, they didn't have a kosher caterer. Ms. Bloomberg was getting older, and she was about to retire. So I did my ufruf. This was for Molly Penner's daughter.
Okay.
I'll remember that as long as I live. They were all nervous for me. You know, it was a big job.
And how many people were you feeding?
I think it was about 200 or
200. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. But I played many penance to be an Orthodox caterer.
Yes.
After they open your products.
And the rabbi has to open it.
Yeah.
You can't open up your own product.
No, if I did, I'd have to take it out.
Oh.
And they called him a mishkia. He was a supervisor over all the foods. And I'd lay my products down, and he'd open them, and then I'm ready to go.
So you couldn't bring any food in that you had already prepared. Everything had to be prepared there on the spot.
Exactly.
And what were the facilities like?
Well, the facilities had two kitchens. A milk kitchen and a meat kitchen. You know, the rule is you can't, even though I was all checked out and had everything, I had to work in a meat kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And in a meat kitchen, you couldn't put no cheese or nothing down in there. You know, their rule in Orthodox is you don't mix milk and meat.
And I didn't realize there were separate kitchens for that. I knew
that
they used separate cookware and separate servingware and plates they eat from.
Some houses had three sets of dishes, which you call meat dishes, dairy dishes, and then parv. Parv is like natural, you know, like you boil spaghettis in and you boil potatoes, and you can't mix nothing there. I had one experience at Beth Israel.
What was that?
I made a beautiful bar mitzvah. You know, you have to be finished cooking. All fires have to be out 5:30 or whenever sundown comes.
On Friday. Oh, gosh.
So if I would have meatballs, little cocktail meatballs, I would have to leave them on a low fire all night because you can't turn the fires on Saturdays. Whatever flame you put it on Friday evening, have to sit like that till after sundown Saturday night.
Now, that's going to require some special cooking tricks because a lot of things couldn't take that much heat.
Well, I found that out, and guess what?
What?
I didn't fix them on meatballs.
Now that you've heard what it took for Bertha Pichon to become the kosher caterer of New Orleans, stay tuned for more. When we come back, Bertha talks about her time as the official City Hall caterer during Dutch Morial's administration and as Ambassador Lindy Boggs' go-to girl for any special event. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Our conversation with kosher caterer Bertha Pichon continues as Bertha takes us back to the early 1960s, when a young Catholic girl with no professional culinary training introduced her distinctly Creole flavors to the Beth Israel Synagogue of New Orleans.
Years ago, the prime minister of Israel came in, and of course he had to go to Beth Israel. The rabbi, the head rabbi, asked me, could I make a New Orleans dish? I said, oh, sure, I'd be happy. So what I did, I made red beans, and I made jambalaya. Of course, not with shrimp and crab.
Right.
But at that time, they were starting to have a bigger market with kosher foods in New Orleans.
Yes.
So they started making sausage. When I first started doing kosher, the only thing they made in anything looked like a sausage was a hot dog. Mm. And I made the jambalaya with chicken and sausage. You know, you couldn't use ham.
Right.
And I made red beans with no meat because being a Catholic, my mother cooked red beans on Friday with a lot of seasoning and a lot of butter. So I had learned that from her. And do you know, the rabbi came and asked me, the prime minister, is this kosher? I said, Rabbi, this is Beth Israel Synagogue. I had to have a mashgiach to check this out. So you could eat it. He said, but it's so good, Miss Pichon. I never test it because it's a New Orleans style. It's a Creole style kosher cooking. And they couldn't believe, he couldn't believe it was strictly kosher. He said, okay.
And what about your special hors d'oeuvres? I know that you were really known for your hors d'oeuvres, I've heard.
I did, because, you know, when you went to any luncheon or dinner, even in a hotel, if it was kosher, their first appetizer was some kind of fruit. Any kind of fruit. They never had nothing else. And one day I was sitting down, I said, well, they got to have something else. So I start making trout cocktail.
Trout cocktail. Now, what was that like?
Well, it was same like you would prepare shrimp or fish. I just poached it and took it apart. Put that on a bed of lettuce, wedge of lemon, and maybe a little parsley. Then I put the cocktail sauce on the side.
Uh-huh.
And mind you, I had to make my cocktail sauce. You didn't have no kosher cocktail sauce.
Right.
So I bought all the ingredients and I had to have all that okayed by the rabbi. Then I made it. Well, I had to make so many fish cocktails after that because that was such a big hit. You know, they never had nothing but fruits.
Yes. Somebody told me I should ask about your stuffed cabbage.
They loved it. You know, stuffed cabbage, that's a two-day job.
And you had to be in the synagogue.
In the synagogue with all
that time.
With all the meats and everything open before I roll that cabbage.
Mm.
Well, the cabbage you didn't worry about because, you know, that was a veggie. But that's what it was. I could make it with the beef filling or I make it with chicken filling.
Well, that just sounds really delicious.
You put a sauce over tomato sauce. I didn't put the heavy Italian over that. I made mine lighter with whole tomatoes or fresh tomatoes with the paste, but made it lighter.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out nice. It was.
And what was the most unusual thing that you were ever requested to make? Were there any shocking requests?
Well, I hate to tell you, they didn't have shocking requests. I'm the one introducing.
You were the you were the surprise.
When I started doing, all they knew was chicken fat, chicken liver, this, that, and that. Now, I improved the chopped chicken liver.
And how did you do that?
Well, I quit using all that chicken fat.
Oh.
See, when Miss Bloomboy was training me, they used to, there was some margarines you could use.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, they didn't have canola oil and all that. So I went to the rabbi, and I told him I would like to use some of the margarine with some of the chicken fat. And it did hold the liver a little better.
Mm-hmm.
So I showed it to him, and I made it one day, and he said, ooh, that's good. Yeah, okay, go. Some people use raw onion in their chopped liver. I don't. I saute onion.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to broil your livers. You couldn't fry them. You had to put them under direct flames in a pan that the blood could drip in the second pan. Now, that's how I learned to make chicken liver.
And that's because of the kosher rules.
Right. Then I couldn't stop making chicken liver.
Now, aside from your kosher catering, at one time, you were caterer for the city of New Orleans. You catered for Lindy Boggs. Tell us about some of the famous folks that you fed.
Well, I was in New Orleans. Whenever she came in, I'd go to the house and all. But after she saw the kind of work I did, and I think, you know, Lindy Boggs was a person, she loved everybody. So there was about quite a few parties I did for Lindy when she was in town, for both big dignitaries and, as she would say, smaller people, you know, that's. And she would be in Washington, and she'd call me, Bertha, this is important party. Clinton's coming down.
Yes.
So you don't have to worry about expense. And she would send me a blank check just with her signature on it.
Oh, my goodness.
Sent me a check before I even did the party. Then I did it a top notch, right? So then I'd make lump crab meat on hearts of palm. I'd make shrimp crescents. I had a caviar hors d'oeuvre, you know, the best caviar. I used to make beef Wellington if she'd ask me, whatever. And that was fine. That was a big time, big party.
And when you were the caterer for the city of New Orleans, how did you get that job, and what was that job like?
Well, I think because Dutch knew I was doing kosher catering all around.
And, of course, we're talking about Dutch Morial, who was the first black mayor of New Orleans.
Correct. So the first thing he had was not the first Mardi Gras, because that's when the police strike was on.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have no Mardi Gras. The next one, I did the Mardi Gras for him.
And where was it held? Where was it?
In Galley Hall.
Mm-hmm.
By then, I had my own catering kitchen, not kosher. I got to make that clear. So anyhow, for Dutch, we sat down, and he told me he wanted me to do Mardi Gras. I said, well, fine with me. But Bert, I got to have corned beef. I said, you got it, Mr. Mayor. So we had corned beef, and I got the rye bread. They were making their own little sandwiches. And it was really a big hit for him.
Now, I'm very curious. You were able to introduce so many kosher people, even from Israel, the flavors of Creole cooking. Did any of those kosher tastes and flavors make it the other way back into your home kitchen?
Yes. My son was sick, my oldest son, Walter.
Yes.
So I'm saying to him, I'm going to make you some chicken soup. That'll be good. He said, you know what I want? I want chicken soup with matzo balls. Now, this is not matzo ball time. You know, matzo ball is like for Passover.
Right.
I said, well, you sure gave me a hard order. I got to go see if Joel have matzo meal. Well, I knew he had matzo meal. That's the gourmet kitchen, you know, on Severin.
Yes.
So that was my order recently, just about 6 months ago. But my family used to want to order chopped chicken liver. Mama, can you make some chicken liver for chaplains? So anything we fix, my children is used to eating kosher foods.
Oh, that's such a great story. Well, I'm so glad we had this chance to have these conversations together, and Thank you for welcoming us into your home.
Well, I'm delighted that you thought enough of me to come in.
Thank you, Miss Pichon.
Now, would you like a piece of matzo ball?
Bertha Pichon, New Orleans Catholic Creole Kosher Caterer. Our Louisiana Eats doctor on call, Tim Harlan, also known as Dr. Gourmet, is back with some edible good advice for having fun at holiday parties and not overdoing it. Tim, welcome back.
Well, it's great to be with you, Poppy. You know, I think the challenge for all of us is that holidays are the times that you want to celebrate. You want to have a good time. But a lot of times we go to party after party after party. And
sometimes in one night.
Exactly. And I've got four pieces of advice. One is eat before you go. You know, a lot of times you don't know what's going to be at that holiday party. You don't know if it's going to even be something that tastes good or that you really like. And so having a little bit of food before you go, maybe even a half a sandwich or some fruit and nuts, et cetera, it's going to help fill you up so you're not so starving by the time you get there and you just hit the table and take whatever's there.
That's a great idea.
The second thing is to drink wisely. One thing is to not get a drink first. You know, most of us, we come through the door at a party, somebody hands us a drink, can I get you a glass of wine, honey? And you have a little bit to drink before, which, especially if you haven't eaten before, reduces your reasoning, shall we say?
Yes.
And maybe you don't make the wisest of choices. You don't have to drink alcohol nonstop. Tonic water is a great choice. Club soda, Perrier, you know, there's so many other fantastic choices. And you're going to enjoy the party oftentimes if you drink a little less.
And, you know, I love the taste of both tonic and soda water with just a little bit of bitters in it.
A little bit of bitters or some lemon or lime, even a maraschino cherry in there. It's
then it looks like a party drink.
Exactly. Once you do hit the buffet, you want to use a plate. So you know you've got some measure of how much you've eaten. If you have not reduced those inhibitions ahead of time by having one or two glasses of wine, then you're going to be able to think through a great quality cocktail meal that just happens to be great for you. I think the last of the four is choosing really wisely. One or two savory pastries, maybe. Eating great food, as you and I have talked about before, is about balance, is about eating great quality stuff that maybe is, quote, not so good for you, and eating some stuff that is really great for you. You and I don't care, Poppy, as long as it tastes fantastic.
Well, I think we are all ready to go out and have some fun, thanks to you, Dr. Gourmet.
Always great to be with you, Poppy.
Louisiana Eats medical consultant Tim Harlan, our very own Dr. Gourmet. Lifelong New Orleanian Mildred Covert is the queen of kosher Creole cooking. Mrs. Covert is a pioneering figure in studies of the culinary lives of Jews in New Orleans and the American South. With Sylvia Gerson, Mildred co-authored the definitive books on how to taste Creole and Cajun while keeping kosher. For years, Mildred was a contributing columnist to the Times-Picayune. Her fresh take on food for the Jewish holidays has inspired generations of kosher cooks. Mildred is here with us to talk about a New Orleans-style Hanukkah. Mildred, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Well, thank you so much. What a wonderful introduction. I hope I live up to it.
This has been just a lifelong dream of mine to get to interview you on this topic, and I'm honored that you're here. And I want to start with a little history. How did your grandmother keep kosher from the moment she stepped off the boat?
Well, it was very interesting because that's all the Jews in those days that came. They all automatically kept kosher. And when she came down here to New Orleans, of course, this was a whole new culinary experience. Some things were comical. Other things were very serious. And like what I call the Jews for centuries all over the country, they had to adapt to wherever they settled. So again, adaptation became the main thing. When she came to New Orleans, she had to adapt to the surroundings, yet she knew which foods were biblically forbidden and were not used in her kitchen. Others she adapted to.
Well, you say that when your grandmother came to the United States, she still believed that tomatoes were poisonous.
Well, she had never food with tomatoes. Now, this was another thing that amazes you when you speak about adaption. She quickly learned to use the tomato. In fact, I think for years, I don't remember any roast coming out of the oven without a tomato sauce on it. But, I mean, she might have gotten a little carried away with it.
Well, tomatoes are the linchpin of Creole cooking.
Exactly, exactly. And so to this day, this is what we used to season a great thing. But the real seasonings, your oregano, your parsley, your thyme, all of those things that are so indigenous to the sauces and to the seasoning of Creole and Cajun, this is all kosher.
Of course, celery, bell pepper, and onions.
Exactly, and the celery and the garlic and all of that. It's just knowing what to blend with what.
Well, I know that you wrote, two of your books were entitled Kosher Creole Cooking and Kosher Cajun Cooking.
Mm-hmm.
The name jambalaya is said to come from the French word for ham, which is jambon, the African word
it's
for
African
rice.
For rice.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. Exactly. And then the a la this and a la that. So it's ham with rice and a little bit of anything. What's jambalaya at your house?
Well, jambalaya is more than just the rice and ham. I mean, even the Cajuns and the Creoles, they put some chicken in it, they put seafood in it, they have shrimp jambalaya, everything like that. So when I make, there's a couple of jambalayas that I make, and my husband loved the one that had a tomato sauce base, and I use the chicken, kosher chicken, take some kosher sausage. When I say sausage right now, I'm really referring to something like a hot dog or a smoked sausage, which comes kosher. And the same and regular ingredients, I mean, certainly nothing wrong with the rice and all the seasoning. And you have the same identical jambalaya. In that case, it really isn't altering the recipe at all. It's simply using a kosher chicken versus one that is not kosher.
I know that it's not kosher to eat shellfish, so crawfish and shrimp are out too.
That's out.
Right?
Lobster, so all of that is out.
How did you cope with that?
There were many recipes that we could substitute things for. There are some recipes that we simply did not include a certain ingredient. There were others that we didn't touch with a 10-foot pole because we didn't know enough about it. I knew nothing about lobster. I knew nothing about crawfish. I knew nothing about the oyster liquid. So any recipes that we might have wanted to convert or to adapt to the kosher kitchen, if that was one of the major ingredients, we steered away from it because it was not something that we knew would come out tasty or, you know, the main ingredient lacking, it is not good. But there were so many other things where we substituted pieces of fish. We could substitute chicken. Or as I said before, there's some things that if you eliminated it, as long as you had that spice and the real seasoning there, that one ingredient was not missed.
Well, you are here for a seasonal reason. Can you tell us about Hanukkah at your house? What's a New Orleans Hanukkah like?
Well, I can tell you. Hanukkah is the holiday that I think is the best one to really celebrate here in New Orleans for several reasons, culinary-wise. We are so known for our fried foods. And this, when you have to fry, what do you need? Your basic ingredient is oil. And when you speak of oil, this is what Hanukkah is about. What we do on Hanukkah is our famous potato latke, which is like a crepe or a pancake, and it's dropped into the oil. But when I think of Hanukkah in New Orleans and all the things that we can do, I have made carrot fritters, apple fritters, banana fritters, corn fritters, all these great New Orleans and Southern fritter kind of thing that you boom, drop into that hot oil. It's the oil that is symbolic of Hanukkah. So there's a lot more affinity here with the Hanukkah celebration food-wise. I can't think of a better place of frying than down here.
Well, Mildred, I am so honored to have this opportunity to say Happy Hanukkah.
Well, thank you. Same to all of you all.
And thanks so much for coming in to talk with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
For more of Mildred's story, as well as other favorites from the past 3 years of our show, pick up a copy of my new book, Louisiana Eats, The People, the Food, and Their Stories, available now in bookstores everywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Hanukkah is known as the Festival of Lights because in 165 BC, after 3 years of fighting the Greeks, the Maccabees were finally victorious in reclaiming the temple on Jerusalem's Mount Moriah. In the temple, they found only enough purified oil to kindle the temple light for a single day. But miraculously, the light continued to burn for 8 days. That's why oil and fried dishes are so important on the Hanukkah table. Could there be a more appropriate way to celebrate this once-in-a-lifetime Thanksgivica than with a Louisiana-style fried turkey? I'll never roast a turkey again in this lifetime, and it's my bet, once you fry your first turkey, your bird will never be relegated to the oven again. But to accomplish this safely, it does take some know-how. Turkey frying must be done outdoors, not on wooden decks or in garages. Set up your burner on a concrete surface like a patio or driveway, a safe distance from any structure. Your turkey should weigh 12 to 18 pounds and be completely defrosted with all innards removed. Most turkey frying pots will hold about 3 gallons of oil, but to be super safe, first determine the correct amount by placing the bird in the cold, empty pot and filling the pot with water until the turkey is just submerged. Then, take the turkey out and mark the water level in your pot. Now that the bird has had his bath, send him back to the kitchen to be thoroughly dried inside and out and injected. Dry the pot thoroughly, too, because moisture is the culprit in many frying eruptions. Fill the dry pot with oil to the marked line. Meanwhile, have your injection liquid prepared and make your own, for goodness sake. Those pre-made injection liquids offered in groceries are filled with chemicals and preservatives. I combine melted butter with orange juice, Leanperin, hot sauce, Peychaud bitters, and then complete the cocktail with bourbon. Inject this deliciousness into the legs, thighs, and breast of the turkey. Turkey frying rigs come with a platform and stabilizing rod for lowering the bird into the oil. You'll also need a frying thermometer to be sure the oil is heated to 350 degrees. Once you begin heating the oil, never leave it unattended. When you're ready to fry, turn the fire off until the bird's in the pot. For total safety, use a broomstick for leverage and keep a safe distance as you suspend the turkey rig over the pot. Make it a two-man operation to slowly lower the bird into the oil. Turn the fire back on and set the timer. A fried turkey cooks 3 to 5 minutes a pound at 325 to 350 degrees. So depending on the weight of the bird, it'll be done in as little as 30 to 40 minutes. Turn the fire off before removing the turkey from the oil. Let it rest for 15 or 20 minutes on paper towel-covered newspaper to absorb any excess oil. When you cut into that fried turkey, you'll discover the most flavorful, moist meat you have ever eaten. We've posted a copy of the frying instructions and my recipe for the injection marinade on our Louisiana Eats website, louisianaeatsradio.org. Happy Thanksgivica
From me and all your friends here at Louisiana Eats. We'll be right back with NOLA Pie Guy Nate Winter, who's filled with advice for making your Thanksgiving desserts unforgettable this year. Stay with us. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Nate Winter is best known in New Orleans as the Pie Guy. We thought that with all the pie baking and eating about to take place at this time of year, he was the perfect man to turn to for advice. Nate, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks for having me back, Poppy. It is always a pleasure.
Well, before we talk pie, let's talk turkey about your new business. So you've got a whole new angle going on. What's happening with the Pie Guy?
I do. I've got a few tricks up my sleeve. I'm lucky enough to announce that I've been selected for a pilot program at the Idea Village in New Orleans, which is a very special place that takes in young New Orleans-based entrepreneurs and kind of gives their startups a little boost. So what they're doing is they've got an 8-week program. They're taking 5 local entrepreneurs and giving them all the resources they can. It's just day in, day out, 24/7 branding, sourcing, pitch practice, outsourcing, anything you need, they're there to support us. So I'm using the opportunity to grow the Pie Guy name and brand because I don't want to just be in New Orleans. I want to be a New Orleans-based company, but I want to spread my love for pies and all sorts of sweets nationwide.
Nationwide, especially Louisiana.
That's right.
So how is this going to happen exactly? You've been assigned a mentor?
Correct. So we've got 2 entrepreneurs in residence, Jay Anthony and Lisa Lloyd, and they are working with us on a weekly basis. And then we also have a group of mentors. So I don't have one particular mentor. I'm sharing 5. Each of these mentors are bringing a different set of kind of specialties to the table. And so I can go to this mentor for branding, this mentor for sourcing, this mentor for logistics, and all these different things. So it's a really holistic approach to support all of us.
Well, that's fantastic. And I guess, of course, you don't have to do any recipe work because you got your recipes down, right?
Exactly.
Well, let's talk pie, Nate. So what do you think the most important element of a pie really is?
I think there's 2. I think there's the environment, so the people that you share it with, because that's my favorite pie memories are always not just the pie, but who I'm having it with. So when it's the holidays, it's with family. When I go back home, it's with friends from college at the diner across the street from Centenary College in Shreveport when we'd all go to Strawn's to drink coffee the morning after an all-nighter and split a pie 4 ways because we all just bombed the same test.
So it's holiday time. Give us your best specific recommendations for the best holiday pies.
Oh, I love the classic. So a good sweet potato and a good pumpkin. I encourage you just to change it up a little bit. Too often recipes call for sugar. Everyone just goes to the cupboard and gets that big bag of white processed sugar. Try cutting half of that with some local raw sugar. There's some beautiful dark brown sugar here in Louisiana and South Louisiana. So try cutting half of your sugar with that raw sugar and you get a really beautiful molasses taste to it. If you've got a local farmer's market, get out there, go to the farmer's market, talk to your farmers and your vendors, find out what's fresh. Maybe they've got some apples that are perfect for baking. Grab those. Maybe they've got some squash that would make a beautiful savory pie. Get that. Maybe they've got some fresh pumpkin. Whatever it is, listen to the people growing the food because that love is going to translate into the final product.
You know, I think the big stumper is the crust.
That's the tricky part. That's what scares most people about pies.
So tell us about that.
So there's a couple different things about pie. There's always the big debate versus lard and butter. And like so many things in life, I'm a big proponent of there's no right answer. You can get a great flake with lard. You can get a really good flake with a high-fat butter. I personally use all butter in mine. Now, there's a couple different ways with gluten, too. People use ice-cold water to bring it together, and that's great. I would also encourage you to try a clear alcohol, maybe vodka. And you can also use dark alcohol, like rum, if you want to get a little bit of flavor in there. And the reason people use alcohol in their pie crust is because you don't want a really tough crust. You want a nice, tender crust to give you that beautiful mouthfeel. So the alcohol stops the gluten from forming when you're kneading that pie dough.
That is an incredible pie-making lesson. Absolutely. I never heard that before.
Yeah. It's great. Vodka, like I said, is a nice neutral way to go if you don't want to mess with the flavor. But if you want to spike it and get a little bit of something on the finish, then try some rum and some bourbon.
So there you have a little bit for the baker, a little bit for the crust.
There you go.
And what about toppings on pies? What are your feelings on that?
I love toppings on pies. I think it's a way to really kind of dress it up or dress it down and play with different flavors and textures. So there's a couple different things you can do. My favorite and one of the easiest is homemade whipped cream. Now, a classic whipped cream, Chantilly, just a sweetened whipped cream, is nothing more than fresh whipped cream whipped with powdered sugar and a little bit of vanilla extract. But there's so much you can do to go that extra mile. The night before, throw in some coffee beans, infuse it. And the next day when you whip it up, you've got a nice coffee-infused whipped cream. You can also do it with mints, any kind of herbs and spices, whatever is fresh in the garden. Just pick it and throw it in the cream.
Oh, that is a great, great idea. Should the pie be baked during dinner? Should it be baked before dinner? When do you think the ideal time to prepare your dessert is?
I think the ideal time to prepare it is as people are arriving. So you've got all the hot food out, you're plating it up, maybe the turkey's being carved or what have you. When you pull it out of the oven, when you get that pie in there in place of the turkey, then you really get those beautiful fall smells, those apples, that browning butter, that burnt sugar, all those wonderful caramelized smells. And that's what's going to make people hungry. That's what's going to remind them of home and the holidays and everything in between.
Well, I am hungry for some pie, so let's have a slice together soon.
Cheers, please.
Thanks, Nate.
Thanks, Poppy. Have a wonderful day.
Nate Winner, New Orleans' own pie guy. Odds are very good that your Louisiana Thanksgiving table might include spinach madeleine. Made famous by the Baton Rouge Junior League cookbook, River Road Recipes, originally published in 1959, this creamy, slightly spicy side dish is now known worldwide. The creator of spinach madeleine, Madeline Wright, is joining us by phone from her St. Francisville home. Mrs. Wright, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Well, thank you.
So tell us, how did spinach madeleine come to be?
Well, it was kind of by accident, actually. I was serving my two-table bridge club for lunch, and I made a cream spinach, and I had this jalapeno cheese I had bought and didn't know what to do with it. I think it had first come on the market. It must have been about 1956. And I just wanted to use it for something, so just on a fluke, I decided to put it in the cream spinach. And something wonderful happened. My friends raved about it at first, and then I served it to a supper club, and the men liked it. And just at that time, the Junior League decided to publish a cookbook, and we were required to turn in three recipes. So spinach was the only thing that I had really created. I didn't consider myself a fine cook. I knew enough to know that if you make a cream sauce and you put cheese in it, it becomes au gratin. So that gave me the courage to put the jalapeno cheese into the cream spinach.
And then you just named it for yourself?
Well, actually, I did. I've always been a little bit embarrassed over that. But I have a philosophy that a name for a dish is very important. And they all have a certain rhythm to the title. Look at shrimp remoulade, oysters Rockefeller, Caesar salad, steak Diane. They all have this little rhythm to them. But anyway, I was looking for a name for my spinach and came across a recipe in a French cookbook that I have for a veal madeleine.
Yeah.
So I said to myself, why not to spinach madeleine?
And the rest is history, huh?
That's right.
So when did you first discover you had such a winner on your hands?
Well, only when people started telling me that, and the book sales picked up, and there have been people who said that the recipe is what sells the book. I don't believe that, because we had a very active committee of Junior League members who, in the beginning, took their cookbook samples with them everywhere they traveled and introduced them to the hotel gift counter or whatever, and they promoted the book very faithfully.
Well, one of the ingredients listed is spinach liquor. Maybe you should explain what that is.
Well, we've had a lot of fun with that, too. The liquor that the vegetables are cooked in is an old-fashioned Southern name. And I put that in, and I think I called it vegetable liquor. It was just the juice off of the spinach, which was to go into the white sauce. And we've had a lot of fun because most of the young people don't know what that means. They don't associate liquor with vegetables. Actually, I have a friend whose daughter was off at school. Actually, she was at the University of Arkansas, and she wanted to make the spinach madeleine. So she went to the liquor store to get this vegetable liquor. And the clerk there said, well, he didn't have any spinach liquor, but that he'd recommend she use bourbon because it was made out of corn.
Okay, here comes the tough question now. What do you do now that Kraft has discontinued making that essential spinach madeleine ingredient, jalapeno cheese?
Well, I'm using that new one. Somebody up in Minnesota, I believe it is, a company called Parker Company, has started making a jalapeno cheese, and they have packaged it kind of like the original Kraft product, which was a little roll of cheese, about 5 or 6 inches long.
Mm-hmm.
And Parker Company is making this one similar to that. It doesn't produce exactly the same results as the Kraft product did.
Oh,
this,
dear.
This is the best substitute that I have found. It's to use, and all the grocery stores in this area at least stock that now.
There is an article online that claims that the dish came from the Green Springs Inn by a woman named Madeleine Neville?
Well, that is I. You see, I've had three husbands.
Okay.
I'm in the River Road. There's Madeleine. I think I'm Mrs. William Raymond in that book. But we weren't progressive enough to use the woman's name. We were always Mrs. somebody or other. But then I married this Texas Aggie whose name was Neville. And when we moved over here, I opened a bed and breakfast. I had divorced that first husband, as I told you, and found myself in a jam. But I opened a bed and breakfast here, and I named it Green Springs Inn. So I did serve it some, but I truthfully got tired of seeing that on the breakfast plate every morning.
That will happen. Well, Mrs. Wright, I want to thank you so much for talking with us on Louisiana Eats, and I want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you very much, and the same to you and all the listeners.
Madeleine Wright of St. Francisville, Louisiana, creator of Spinach Madeleine. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, the Hanukkah celebration continues with culinary historian Michael Twitty.
Hanukkah is my time with my Jewish family, people who have helped me in my journey from my conversion onward. Our arms are never too wide to embrace each other.
Subscribe to our podcast. Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan & Company and LCI Workers' Comp.
Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh, consulting producer Margaret Howes, and sound engineer Guy Mulladew. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.